Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tori King, Professor of Public Engagement and Genetics at the University of Leicester, and today I'm talking to Ken Pounds, Emeritus Professor of Space Physics at the University of Leicester. And I have to admit, I'm really looking forward to talking to you. You've had such an amazing career. I know the university is renowned for its space research for over 60 years, and that is in no small part down to you. So you've been one of the founding fathers of UK space research field. Tell me, where did your interest in space start?
Well, for me, it was very much a case of being in the right place at the right time. I went to UCL to read for a physics degree in 1953. The head of department, Sir Harry Massey, was, it turned out, a prime mover in space science in the UK and Europe. During the years when I was an undergraduate, there were discussions between American scientists and British scientists about the possibility of exploring directly the properties of the upper atmosphere. The Americans had got some captured V2 rockets that they'd been doing simple experiments with, but they were inefficient and clearly something else was needed. And so there was a conference at Queen's College in Oxford between the Americans and the British scientists who were interested in that kind of thing. It was also attended by people from the military, because there was an interest in the atmosphere, knowing more about the atmosphere, the density, winds and ionization and all of that sort of thing. Because I think that some of the strategists thought that maybe the next wars would be fought either through or in space. Anyway, after this Queen's College meeting, there was an offer made from the Royal Aircraft Establishment, who were involved then in developing guided missiles, to use a missile and change it into something that could be used for what they call rocket sounding, which is basically a suborbital rocket that will go up way higher than had been directly explored with balloons until then, right through the atmosphere and measure all these things that people were interested in. So by 1954, an offer was actually made to convert a missile into a rocket that quite quickly actually became the Skylark sounding rocket that for many years after that was one of the best research rockets around. And that synergy you can see all the way through the development of space research around the world, in Russia, in America, and so on. And by 1956... there was a serious prospect of having a competitive rocket. The Treasury, as I was going to say, had been persuaded to give £100,000, which doesn't sound a lot, but in current buying power, it would be millions. And half of that was going to go to the RAE to build rockets for scientific purposes, the other half to five university groups, not including Leicester. And the principal theme of the research was going to be understanding the atmosphere. I was offered an Admiralty scholarship to join the rocket group. I didn't obviously think about it too carefully, because at the time there wasn't a rocket. I mean, it was still, in design, in planning. But nevertheless, the idea of 3 more years as a student, playing for the university football team, it sounded quite appealing. So I actually signed up for that. And it wasn't until the end of my third year, when my scholarship was just about to run out, that I did get the first flight of a small instrument on a Skylark from Woomera. That takes us to the end of 59, when I was offered the chance to move to Leicester to a lectureship. Sort of a bit out of the blue, but again, if my work was going to progress, then I think UCL were very constrained on space at Gower Street, and I think they were looking for expanding somewhere, and the obvious place to go would be to the physics laboratory at Leicester, where I'd visited a couple of times to calibrate my equipment during that three-year PhD study. So anyway, I was essentially transferred, I think, to Leicester. offered this assistant lectureship. So I didn't apply for it. I was offered it. But it was, for me, nevertheless, a great setup because I got free accommodation, more than twice the amount of income that I'd had before, and basically, you know, bachelor with no ties. And so I really enjoyed that first year, 2 years, actually, before I then got married.
So in 1960, you've arrived at the University of Leicester and you're founding the Space Research Group. So tell me about those early days of when you first arrived.
The attraction of Leicester in the first place was that they had vacuum X-ray facilities that I'd been using during my PhD study. And they had people working in that area, not space, but studying rare earth metal structures. The head of the department was involved in that, Professor Edward Stewardson. There was a senior lecturer and another lecturer and three research students. So we had already a team there ready to go. And then very soon afterwards, we had a rather large grant of money from the Royal Society. That arrived, I think, 6 months after I'd started, for £13,000 for a three-year study to study X-radiation from the sun or other stellar sources. That was our remit as an additional group to the original five universities.
I'd really love to know, what was the university like at the time? Where were you based? Was it a big department?
The university was a very different place. I mean, the world was a very different place in 1960. Initially, we were based in the Fielding Johnson building, presently the administration building, and physics occupied the front corridor, ground floor, and other facilities were very limited. So the only telephone in the department was in the prof's office. And so if I needed to make a call to NASA headquarters, for instance, then I'd got to persuade the head of department secretary to allow me to have an external line to the university switchboard, which was run by Mr. Kimber, who was a blind gentleman who wandered around the campus with the dog, but also not easily persuaded to put you through to somewhere like NASA. It sounded expensive. So that was a bit of a drawback and, of course, quite a contrast to these days. Obviously, in many ways, nowhere near as good as it was later, but in some other ways, very nice place to work. I mean, it was small, compact, everybody knew everybody else.
It sounds idyllic. It sounds very collegiate, certainly. I've read that you were one of the pioneers of using rockets and satellites for research in the UK in the 1960s and the 1970s. So how were you using them and what could you use them for?
Yes, the national background was that largely due to people like Harry Massey, the head of physics at UCL, the UK had positioned itself really quite strongly in an emerging field of science and applications, of course, that followed quickly from the launch of Sputnik by the Soviet Union in 1957. And I like to think that one of the UK responses was to expand the university programme and establish a group at Leicester in 1960. There was more to it than that, of course. The UK government, I think, were being dragged along slightly nervously with this rapidly expanding push towards space. And so the outcome was that by the time I came to Leicester, the UK had a decently funded programme of Skylark rockets and also a series of small satellites that had been offered to countries around the world by NASA, aiming, I think, to increase the American influence on this growing field rather than allow the Soviets to do that. And so Harry Massey, again, took the lead. And so when I came to Leicester, already there was the first of these joint satellites called Ariel satellites. Ariel 1 was approved, and we were involved in it. And I think one of the reasons for the urgency of getting me transferred to Leicester was that we would be responsible for building the X-ray detectors for Ariel 1. And Ariel 1 was at that time scheduled for launch in 1961, so there wasn't really a lot of time. The rest of the payload was on the same theme as in the early Skylarks, to basically study the properties of the upper atmosphere and the ionosphere. So arriving in Leicester, then the first priority was Ariel 1. And we did our work for that. We delivered the detectors to Goddard Space Flight Center near Washington, where Ariel 1 was being put together. At that time, we in the UK didn't have the capability really to build scientific satellites or even any kind of satellites, because there's lots of new, you know, technical requirements. So that was part of the deal. So all of that went ahead quite successfully. And in April 1962, Ariel 1 was launched into orbit on a Thor Delta rocket. And I started to receive X-ray spectra, fairly crude X-ray spectra from a proportional gas counter, so not with details of line emission and absorption and things like that, but the broad spectrum, which would give people interested in the heating of the ionosphere and the atmosphere a good measure of the heat input, different wavelengths and therefore different levels of penetration. And that worked fine for about 7 weeks. And then in July 1962, everything went haywire. And my detectors just went mad, you know, counting rates off the scale. And I thought, oh dear, we know we've got an electrical breakdown. However, it turned out that other instruments on board were suffering the same way. A cosmic ray experiment from Imperial College had also gone mad. Subsequently, it turned out that unbeknown to NASA, the US Air Force had decided to explode, against all the rules and regulations, a hydrogen bomb in the atmosphere over the Pacific, over Johnston Island at about 400 kilometres. And this had injected an enormous flux of basically radioactive debris into the Earth's magnetic field through which our satellite was flying. And seven other satellites, mostly NASA satellites, were also damaged by this incident of lack of cooperation, I suppose, between two big US agencies. So basically that was the end of it for Ariel 1. So that sounded a bit like an early setback. In fact, the technique that was based on what I'd done for my thesis, using proportional counters to get crude but continuous measurements of the solar X radiation, did carry on. And for the, working with UCL for the rest of the 60s, we actually flew more advanced versions of this experiment on two NASA satellites and the first ESRO scientific satellite. That for us was basically where we changed our priorities, because remarkably, a month before this calamity, there was another surprise coming out of America. And that was when a small group in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had been flying a small rocket, very similar to Skylark, but they flew it at night time. And it's difficult to find out really what the motivations was, but the official motivation was to look at the moon and to see to what extent it might scatter X-rays, solar X-rays. However, they didn't see any X-rays from the moon. But what they did see was this remarkably bright source, which looked like a star in the constellation of Scorpius. But what could it be? Because in some parts of the spectrum, it was actually as bright as the sun. You know, so it was really a quite incredible thing. What could it be? And that was the beginning of cosmic X-ray astronomy. And that, for us, you know, with a group of young, enthusiastic scientists and technicians who'd got Skylark to play with, could see as being where we really wanted to be, rather than just looking at a boring old sun. So our priorities changed very quickly during the 1960s as we started to use Skylark to explore the night sky.
So tell me more about this, exploring the night sky using Skylark.
Well, with this dramatic discovery of what became called Scorpius X-1 by the American group in Cambridge, there was wide interest, of course, of A, what could this possibly be, this extremely luminous X-ray source, and B, for us at least, the great opportunity since we had Skylark, there was at least as competitive as the one that had made this discovery, that we could use to have our own look around the night sky. And in particular, flying from Woomera, we had the southern hemisphere sky to look at, whereas the Scorpius X-1 was a source observed from the north. So that became rapidly our objective during the 1960s. And we flew four increasingly powerful survey flights on Skylark through that period. The outcome of that was very satisfactory. We found that there were indeed quite a lot of other sources of this kind, these other strange stellar sources in the southern hemisphere, in Centaurus, Norma, and other regions in the south. So the question then became, what were these objects? I mean, how could they be emitting X-rays a million times more powerful than the sun? Obviously not normal stars, and therefore very likely not energized by nuclear fusion, which normal stars are. And the obvious alternative, which had been contemplated by theorists for quite a while, that it must be something to do with strong gravity. It must be something to do with the fact that if mass is converted to energy through gravity, sort of extreme cases of Newton's apple, then you can get more energy out of a given mass than you can from nuclear fusion. And that would be the case if, for example, you had a star which had, for some reason, collapsed into a much smaller object. That was the favourite explanation for actually Scorpius X-1. It was, in fact, a collapsed star, probably of a kind called a neutron star, where the star itself had collapsed to neutron density. So the atoms within the star had been crushed together, and the electrons into the protons. So basically, it was just a big ball of neutrons. So that seemed to be a very decent explanation. So it could well be that most of these objects that we were seeing, and the Americans were continuing to find others in the northern hemisphere, were basically neutron stars, but not isolated neutron stars. An isolated neutron star is either not visible or is likely to be a radio source if it's magnetized. What could make one an X-ray source is if it's in a binary system with another star, where the other star can provide matter, which, when falling on the neutron star, converts matter into energy at a very high efficiency of a few percent compared to a fraction of a percent with nuclear fusion. And that was probably what was going on with SCOIX-1, and I think quite a few of the other sources that we were finding. And there are now known to be maybe a billion neutron stars in our galaxy. So a neutron star is a common end product of a relatively massive star that collapses under its own weight, if you like, and when its fusion reactor stops working, runs out of fuel. So the next step had to be to get more information, and that had to be to move from rocket flights that gave you like a 10-minute observation to satellites that would allow you to study them for much longer periods and get more information. For instance, did the X-rays vary? Did they vary in a periodic way? Or what other signals were there? So into the early 1970s, then the move was into satellites. And that's when, again, the Americans got there first with the Uhura satellite launched in 72. But we were fortunate that we had the aerial satellites, and one of those, Ariel 5, gave us the chance to follow them into orbit with a launch in 1974. And that really opened up a new chapter for us in the UK, particularly at Leicester. And Ariel 5 was, I think, the mission that finally put us right at the forefront of the subject for a period of time.
So Ariel 5 was clearly very important. Tell me about what that was used for.
Well, Ariel 5 was one of the series I was saying. It was launched on a relatively small solid fuel rocket called Scout, same as Uhuru, the American predecessor. Both of them were launched into an ideal orbit for what we wanted to do, into an equatorial orbit, a low Earth orbit, which sits beneath the radiation belts that had still then got accumulations from the bomb. which lasted for a couple of decades. So Ariel 5 was duly launched, went into orbit, and worked really very well for 6 years. And during that time, I think it's fair to say that it put LESTER very much in a leading role in X-ray astronomy around the world. We got off to a dramatic start, actually, because in the first year we had decided it was a small spinning satellite, about 150 kilograms. The way in which it was operated was our main detectors were looking out of the side in the spin plane. We could control the spin axis using magnetorquers. And so one of the things we decided to do in the first year was to just sit with the satellite spin axis pointing at the galactic pole. So we were scanning around the Milky Way continuously for as much as 10 days just to see what was going on, because we knew that the brightest sources were likely to be close to the galactic equator, within our galaxy, in other words. And we did that, and that turned out to be really quite interesting because we found many new sources. We finished up with a total of over 350, so an order of magnitude more than was found during the rocket era. And a lot of them were variable, which was really interesting because that gave us another signal as to what was actually going on. So we found some sources came and went, so they just became called transient sources, and, you know, who knows what they might have been? Who knows when they may reappear? But there was one that was really not ignorable, and that was found by one of our students who was on duty monitoring the data as it came in. We got data every day, which made it all more exciting, which was printed out in the department at the university. And this chap, Richard Griffiths, research student, was on duty on the Friday, and he saw this little blip in the printout that had not been seen before, and probably put an asterisk on the side and thought, keep an eye on that. However, he had arranged to go off with his girlfriend that weekend, so he cleared off, which was really a bad career move, and another colleague, Martin Elvis, volunteered to take over. Well, during that weekend, this blip became bigger and bigger, and by Monday was already the brightest source in the sky, brighter than Scorpius X1. It carried on getting even brighter for a few more days, and then a slow decline over the next few months. But during that time, the world astronomy community basically had been staring at this object, and over the next year or so, it was established by a collaboration of astronomers with quite a strong UK contingent, actually, that what we were looking at was another binary system with a fairly normal star, a bit like the Sun, in a close orbit with a black hole. Now, the key to deducing that this is a black hole, not a neutron star, was from the dynamics of the orbit to determine the mass of this object, because neutron stars were not believed to exist above a mass of about 2 solar masses, because then the nuclear structure would not withstand the weight, if you like. We determined from the dynamics of the observations was at least 3 solar masses. Subsequently, it was found to actually be about 6 solar masses. So the unseen thing at the centre of this orbit had to be a black hole. It was far too massive to be a neutron star. But that was an exciting period of work with Ariel 5. But over the following 6 years, I think Ariel 5 made a more enduring discovery, and that was the subject that basically kept me interested ever since. And that is that we found evidence that so-called active galaxies that had been known for a while, things like quasars and Seyfert galaxies, which showed themselves to conventional telescopes to be just galaxies like a spiral galaxy with a very bright nucleus. What we found was in a sample of about 15 of these active galaxies, they were all powerful X-ray emitters. So there was a really strong hint there that there was something highly unusual creating powerful X-ray radiation, not just normal stars clustered at the centre. The next satellite we were involved in, actually, the European satellite Exosat, did add a very crucial additional piece of evidence there, in that, remarkably, we found, looking at these active galaxies, that you really wouldn't expect on a galactic scale rapid variability, but we found they were varying. The X-ray emission was varying on timescales of hours. And that tells you immediately that you're looking at an energy source that has got a size that can't be more than a light hour or so across. So that is very much then like a scaled up stellar black hole. And in fact, that turns out to be what we were seeing. What we were seeing at the centre of these active galaxies were supermassive black holes of masses of millions of solar masses, which were accreting material from surrounding stars, which were being ripped apart, etc., and emitting X-rays. The X-rays produced because when the matter falls in towards the black hole, it's losing gravitational energy, but it's a lot of that's being turned into heat. So you're actually seeing its thermal emission from material at temperatures of millions of degrees before it finally disappears down the black hole and is lost.
So in 1980, the main source of space science funding changed in the UK. So what happened with that?
One of the issues, I think, to be fair, was that the next step was going to be almost certainly quite a lot more expensive. I mean, you know, that is how things go in big science and astronomy and space, particle physics and so on. And so I think there was a logic to the UK to be looking at least for collaboration. And it was connected, I think, politically at the time with the European Common Market, with De Gaulle having rejected Britain. And so I think there was a push elsewhere to carry out more of our work where it made sense in a European context. And of course, already there was CERN, which was a highly successful particle physics laboratory in Geneva. And so around that same time, at the beginning of the 80s, I think the decision was made by the scientific community that we should put our space projects within ESA as appropriate. But for us, when we were faced with the loss of Skylark, our last Skylark was in 76. We'd been flying Skylarks for 15 years, total of over 50 altogether over that time. The aerial series was coming to an end, and therefore the best opportunity for us seemed to be through Europe, although we were also keen to maintain what used to be called bilateral projects with other countries around the world where we could find a sensible collaboration. As it turned out, we managed to make progress in both those areas. But the external factor that was also influencing things at the time was that the NASA X-ray program basically got stalled because their next ambition after Uhuru was a really ambitious X-ray observatory, which was called AXAF at the time. And eventually, when it got into orbit 20 years later, was Chandra, which is still functioning. But what it meant was that in America, there was a 20-year gap beginning to open up, and that needed filling. So one of the ways in which we were involved in it being filled was to look for other ways forward. And the first opportunity for us came through ASRO/ESA. In the form of a satellite called Exosat. It was basically a somewhat larger satellite than Ariel 5 in a different orbit. The orbit was a deep space orbit, which spent some of its time quite close to the Earth, but most of its time a long way out from Earth, which was a really good place to be because it meant that you could have long observations without the Earth getting in the way. You know, observations of several days, which turned out, certainly for the science I'm interested in, to be really important. We had a head start with the other groups that had helped build the hardware, which is only fair, I guess, in that we had some guaranteed observations early on. So for the first year, we did rather exploit that. And one of the things that turned out to be really quite important in my area was that we spent several days staring at these bright active galaxies just to see if there was any way of pinning down the link to supermassive black holes. And astonishingly, we found that for several of them, the X-ray emission varied strongly on timescales of hours. Now, that immediately tells you that the source of emission is very compact, can't be more. To get coherent emission from an X-ray source, it has to be, you know, less than the light travel time associated with the variability. So we were seeing objects that looked very much like scaled up black holes. And anyway, it turns out that's indeed what they were. Other information was required to prove that. But I think we now know that what makes active galaxies active is that they have a supermassive black hole at the centre. Not just that, but a black hole that is being fed by mass from surrounding stars or whatever to cause it to light up. And it lights up mainly in X-rays because of the temperature reached by the accreting gas is typically millions of degrees. So Exosat, just for that reason, but for many other areas of X-ray astronomy as well, turned out to be a really effective mission that basically, I think, dominated the world scene in X-ray astronomy for quite a few years through the 1980s.
Thank you so much for your time, Ken. That's all we have time for today. Make sure to tune into the next episode to hear Professor Ken Pounds answer whether he himself wanted to be an astronaut, what questions in his field he would love to know the answers to, and discusses big space projects at the University of Leicester. Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.